So the last day or so, you've heard a lot of talks about phases that are deconfined, which have deconfined gauge fields, and which show fractionalization. Today, I'll talk about phase transitions that have this property, that show fractionalization and deconfined gauge fields, although these phase transitions will be between phases that are completely conventional, okay, which don't have these properties. And we'll see that these phase transitions are also Landau forbidden in a certain sense, and you know, show very features that are very different from conventional phase transitions. So mainly I'll be talking about work done with Central, Leon, Subir, and Subir Sachdev and Matthew Fisher. You don't really need all these photographs. Many of them are right here. And a little bit about work done with Lessig. He's talked about that. Sorry? Okay, so why are quantum phase? So why do we study quantum phase transitions? Of course, quantum phase transitions are transitions that happen at zero temperature driven by quantum fluctuations. And one of the main reasons it's interesting for a theorist to study these transitions is because of universality. Okay, so you really need to specify very few things in order to completely describe the long-distance physics at a quantum phase transition, and most of the microscopic details of your system are just irrelevant to describing the physics. Okay, so that's a very nice situation for a theorist. And the other reason, of course, is that although this is a phase transition that happens at zero temperature at some point in parameter space, it can control properties of a large fan at finite temperatures, a large fan of parameter space at finite temperatures. And the physics of your system in this fan is very different from, you know, the physics of your regular phases, you know, conventional phases and so on. So often in systems, if you see strange behavior at finite temperature, you might be tempted to associate it with physics of a nearby quantum phase transition, although you may not be actually able to tune your system into that quantum phase transition. Okay, so you may be just living in this region of parameter space, but you see that there's some strange physics at finite temperature, and perhaps if you were able to tune your system, you'd see that there's a quantum phase transition nearby. Okay, so for this reason, sometimes we label this axis by some unknown parameter, because by universality, it may not even be important to know what this parameter is. And also because sometimes in a physical system, you may not really need to tune that parameter in order to see physics of the quantum phase transition. Okay, so let me just give a few words of motivation before I start on the main subject of this talk. One of the main reasons for interest in these quantum phase transitions is because there are several problems in strong correlation physics which seem to defy conventional understanding. Okay, so one famous example is this physics of the the cuprate superconductors at temperatures above their optimal TC, okay, where you see this very linear resistivity curve up to extremely high temperatures. And people have speculated that this may be due to some underlying quantum critical point, although nobody is really sure what this quantum critical point is and what phases it separates and so on. But anyway, this has been one reason for a lot of activity in this field. The other strong motivation comes from from a physical system where we are more sure that there is a quantum phase transition. So this is the problem of magnetic ordering in a metallic environment. The systems of most interest are these heavy fermion systems where you you go between a non-magnetic metal and a magnetic metal across this quantum phase transition. And it turns out that in several of these systems, if you sort of do the most conventional theory that you could think of, just write down a Landau theory of fluctuations of this order parameter, plus some damping coming from this metallic environment, that theory differs in some fundamental ways from the experimental data. Okay, so so that has been one of the outstanding problems in this field of quantum phase transitions. And you can give several, you can try to think of several reasons why this might, you know, this disagreement between the obvious theory and experiments might be true. but one reason might be, is that one reason could be that we don't really understand quantum phase transitions that well. Okay, so the space of possibilities open to us at a quantum critical point is larger than just the, you know, thinking of fluctuations of the obvious order parameter. Okay, and this is really going to be the subject of the talk. I want to show you an example where indeed this is true, that there are quantum phase transitions which really cannot be thought of within Landau's paradigm an order. Although there's a phase with a definite order parameter, you can't really think of the quantum critical point as simply fluctuations of that order parameter. However, the system I'll be thinking about is not really the system over here, or the cuprate system for that matter, where you have both spin and charge degrees of freedom. Rather, it's going to be a much simpler system where you only have spin degrees of freedom. So in other words, it's a quantum magnet where all the charge is sort of nailed down to the sides, and the dynamical degrees of freedom are just the spins. Okay, so the specific model I'd be interested in is a spin half system on a square lattice in two dimensions, okay, two spatial dimensions. In fact, this is realized by the parent compound of the high temperature superconductors, for example, lanthanum copper oxide, zero doping compound. Okay, so the Hamiltonian for this system would include some exchange interaction between the spins, some antiferromagnetic exchange interaction between the spins, and perhaps some other terms. Okay, so you can ask, what is the ground state of this system? And actually, it took a while to figure out the ground state of the system with only nearest neighbor interactions, and it turns out that that's a nail state. Okay, so that's simply the state where your spins are pointing in, are essentially pointing in opposite directions on the different on the two sublattices. So there's an order parameter, just simply the staggered spin, and the low energy excitations of this system are just the Goldstone modes of this broken symmetry. It's just spin waves. Okay, so this is in one regime of parameter space. You can, however, imagine increasing quantum fluctuations, making the system more and more quantum. For example, one way to do that might be to add a J prime thing, J prime exchange between these two spins, which frustrates this nail order and drives it to some other state. There are other interactions you could imagine putting in to destroy nail order. And then another natural state that you you might end up with is a valence bond solid state. Okay, so this is a state where you take pairs of spins and form singlets, and then arrange these singlets in some pattern in the square lattice. Now, because you're on the square lattice with spin a half, this arrangement, if it's frozen, has to break some lattice symmetry. So this is one particular arrangement, which is called a columnar dimer state. Okay, and this state clearly breaks translation symmetry along this direction and lattice rotation symmetry. Okay, so associated with these symmetry breakings, the spatial symmetry breakings, you can associate an order parameter for these valence bond states. And this order parameter just takes on, you know, it's one, let's say, for this particular arrangement. And then it's very natural to associate for this 90 degree rotated arrangement a value of I for this order parameter, and so on for the other two columnar dimer states. There's another version of this valence bond solid state, which is a Plaquette order state, where along these bonds there's stronger singlet formation than along these other bonds, these plaquettes that are not circled. And if you work out what the valence bond order parameter for this state is, it's something that points at one of these minus 45 degree angles. And there are three other states of this kind, and you can imagine how this, you can guess how this valence bond solid order parameter rotates about its 90 degrees to this one. Okay, so what are the excitations in this valence bond solid state? The first excitation you can make is simply to take one of these singlets and promote it to a triplet. So that's really the magnon excitation. There's a gapped excitation that can propagate about this lattice, because that's the content of this the excitation spectrum of the state. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to draw a phase diagram which includes these two obvious candidates, these two obvious states. Okay, so let's imagine we have this parameter G. You could think of it as the ratio of J prime over J, for example, but not necessarily. It could be anything that increases quantum fluctuations as you go this way. For small values of G, you have the nail state, where you have this nail order parameter being non-zero, but this valence bond solid order parameter being zero. And the question is, as I increase these quantum fluctuations, at large quantum fluctuations, you expect this valence bond solid state to occur. Valence bond order parameter is non-zero, but the nail order parameter is zero. And the question is, how can we go between these two? Now, coming from the point of view of classical phase transitions, there's actually something you can say immediately about how this transition might occur or how it might not occur. And this is a constraint from Landau's theory of phase transitions. Actually, it's almost just common sense. You have two phases that are very different orders. Okay, one is nil ordered, one is valence bond solid ordered. And it's not hard to argue that in general, you won't have a direct transition that's continuous between them. Okay, so if you wanted a situation where the nil order parameter goes to zero exactly at the same point as the valence bond solid order parameter, this situation will require special fine-tuning in Landau's theory. Okay, so what's generic for a transition between these two is a first-order transition, for example, that can always occur. You can go from some finite strength of the nil order parameter and jump to a finite strength of this valence bond solid order parameter. That's always an option. Or else what you would expect is that this nil order parameter goes to zero, but you know, sometime before that you develop this valence bond solid order. So in between you have both order parameters in this coexistence regime. Okay, so and you could of course have this, which I won't talk about, something subtle about this scenario. But you know, these are sort of the generic expectations. You don't expect that the nil order parameter goes to zero at exactly the same point as the valence bond solid order parameter. That's extremely unlikely and requires a lot of fine tuning. Okay, so these are the this is what you expect from you know, classical phase transition physics, and also you know, very simple arguments, almost common sense arguments. But the point of this talk is that for quantum phase transitions, these considerations are not correct, or this conclusion that you derive for phase transitions is not correct for quantum phase transitions. Okay, so I'll present a theory of a direct continuous transition between the nil and valence bond solid order parameters, which is a generic possibility. It doesn't require any special fine-tuning. Okay, so in fact, it's a Landau. In that sense, it's a Landau forbidden transition. And we'll see that what's crucial in all of this is that in the quantum problem, there are Berry phases that enter in the description of the problem, and that's crucial in order to get this physics to occur. Okay, I'll also talk about the properties of such a critical point, and it turns out to have several properties that are rather unusual. So first of all, if you somehow accept that this continuous transition is possible, you might then think that the physics at this critical point is simply the fluctuations of these two order parameters. Okay, so that will turn out not to be true also. The correct theory of the critical point is not simply fluctuations of the obvious order parameters. Rather, there are some other fields, photons and spinons, fractionalized excitations, that are the natural fields that define that describe the criticality at this point. Okay, and also we'll show that I'll also describe in some sense that this transition is topologically ordered. I'm using this word in the sense of Thouless, that certain topological configurations are absent at the transition. Okay, so this is going to be these are going to be the properties of the critical point. Clearly, very exotic properties. But I want to emphasize the phases we are talking about on either side of the critical point are completely conventional. Okay, they have no deconfined gauge fields, no fractionalization. They're simple cartoons that you can draw of these phases. Okay, so in order to do that, first I have to tell you how to describe quantum magnets. And one very convenient way of doing this is to consider the quantum partition function for the quantum magnet. In fact, it's convenient to write it in terms of this nil vector, the staggered spin. And on this, on bipartite lattices, you can define a quantity like this that gives you the staggering of the spin. And you can rewrite this quantum partition function in terms of a path integral over spin configurations in space-time. There's this factor that weighs the different spin configurations, but there's also a Berry phase factor that depends on the history of each spin, the solid angle it sweeps out. So you take the solid angle that each spin sweeps out and multiply by the value of the spin. In this case, the spin is half. Okay, so that's really the description of the quantum problem. And we are supposed to sum over all the different histories of the spins with weighing with this very oscillatory phase factor. Okay, so that seems like quite a daunting task, but luckily that's been done for us many years back by Duncan Haldane. So he considered a situation where the nil vector is slowly varying. Okay, so you have reasonably well-established nil correlations, at least at short distances. And we'll think of a way of starting at that point and seeing how to disorder this quantum magnet. Okay, so really this will be an approach starting from the nil side and thinking about disordering the nil phase. So in the next talk, Senthil will talk a little bit about starting from the opposite end, from the valence bond solid side, and approaching this transition from the opposite end. And of course, we'll get the same conclusions, but from very different directions. Okay, but back to this prescription of Haldane's. So if you have if you can define a slowly varying local nail vector, then you can actually write down a certain prescription how the different space-time configurations of the nail field are weighed in this partition function. Okay, so I won't derive this this result. I'll just describe it to you. So you weigh, it's given a certain configuration of the nail vector in space-time. You weigh each of them by this factor. And this factor has two pieces. There's one piece that likes to keep the nail fields together. Okay, so it's just something that likes to establish nail order. But there's another piece, a berry phase term, that has its origins in these berry phases for each spin. And this berry phase term is absent for smooth configurations of spins, but it's only active when you have a hedgehog configuration of this nail field. Okay, so what's a hedgehog? You've heard about this from Oleksiy Mortonich's talk. But really, a hedgehog is some space-time configuration of the nail field that looks like this. And that's radially pointing out or radially pointing in into a cube. And you can make this definition precise. And every cube, you can define a hedgehog number, and it's some integer, okay, plus, minus 1, 0, and so on. Okay, and these hedgehogs are actually events. So if you have a hedgehog event, Haldane's prescription says that you've got to take that event and weigh it with a certain berry phase. You know, there's a certain berry phase factor that comes with each of these hedgehogs. And this phase factor depends on which spatial plaquette your hedgehog appears above. Okay, so you divide your square lattice into four kinds of spatial plaquettes, and you associate a complex number with each of these spatial plaquettes. And if you get a hedgehog appearing over this kind of spatial plaquette, you just weigh it with one. But if it's above this kind of spatial plaquette, then you weigh it with this phase factor I, and so on. Okay, so this is the berry phase factor that with which you weigh the hedgehogs. Okay, so one thing to note over here is that the fourth power of all of these phase factors is unity. So if you have four hedgehogs appearing at a point, that's something that gets the same phase factor irrespective of where it appears. Okay, that's going to be important later on thing. Okay, so that's how you describe quantum magnet, spin a half quantum magnet square lattice. Turns out all of those things are important in this description. but anyway, let's see how we get the two phases, the nail and the VBS phase, within this description. Okay, so to understand the nail phase, that's rather easy. If you imagine this J parameter being very large, all of these nail fields are locked to each other. Just get the nail phase. There are no hedgehogs really in this phase because it's ordered. It's very expensive to make hedgehogs. So you basically get the nail phase for large values of J. Okay, now if you go to small values of J, you get large fluctuations of this nail field, and it turns out that the hedgehogs proliferate in this regime of parameter space. And a very non-trivial result, which is due to Reed and Suchdev, again many years back, is that the result of these hedgehog proliferations, the result of proliferating hedgehogs with these berry phases, is that you get the valence bond solid phase. Okay, and one way to understand that very roughly is that these hedgehogs carry berry phases that depend on which plaquette they're sitting over. So they know about so if they condense, they can break translation symmetry and give you the valence bond solid phase. Okay, so I can describe more about how exactly this association comes about if there are questions at the end. Okay, so, but in order to understand the region in between, it turns out it's very useful to think about the hedgehog-free model that Oleksiy Mortonich was discussing in the previous talk. First consider the hedgehog-free model and then put back hedgehogs. Okay, so we'll establish the physics of this, remind you of the physics of this model first, and then see how that physics is changed when you put back the hedgehogs with these berry phases into the problem. Okay, so let me just remind you very quickly, the hedgehog-free model is most naturally described in terms of this non-compact CP1 field. It contains photons coupled to spinons. There are two kinds of spinons. And how are these fields related to our original nail fields? The spin half fields, the spinons are, are sort of the square roots of the nail field. A bilinear of these spinons makes up the nail field. This is the Pauli matrix. And the photon you can associate with the chirality of the nail vector. Okay, so if you have a plaquette like this, for example, if you had a triangular plaquette, it's just N1 dot N2 cross N3, where 1, 2, and 3 are the three spins. It's just the nail vector chirality. So you have a way of going between the original layer fields and these other variables, which are the natural variables to describe this hedgehog free model. Okay, and really the action of the Lagrangian to describe such a model, the Euclidean Lagrangian, has these spin-ons hopping about coupled to a gauge field and a non-compact action for the gauge field. Again, this non-compactness is completely crucial. It comes from the fact that we have no hedgehogs model. Okay, so what is the phase structure of this hedgehog-free model? As described before, there are two phases. There's a phase where the spins are disordered, the nail fields are disordered, which is this P star phase, where we have a gapless photon and gap spin-ons. Okay? And as you move, as you change this coupling J, this gap to the spin-ons comes down, and at some point they're critical, and then they condense. And once the spin-ons condense, they carry a spin, so the resulting state that you get a break spin symmetry, it's the nail phase. And also the photon is gapped because you have a condensate of gate charged particles. And the critical point is when all of these fields are gapless, basically, or gapless photons interacting very strongly with these gapless spin-ons. Okay, so that's the physics of this hedgehog-free model. And this transition is very different from the regular Heisenberg ordering transition. Okay, now what we want to do is we want to reintroduce the hedgehogs, okay, along with their berry phases, and ask how much of this physics survives that reintroduction. Okay, so so let's start with the nail phase. What happens if we start with this hedgehog-free model in the nail phase and allow for some hedgehogs? Okay, so that's easy to see. Your nail phase is stable, it's ordered phase. It's very expensive to make hedgehogs. And at least for the ground state properties, you know, if you start with some particular hedgehog fugacity, so I'm thinking of one over the hedgehog core energy as some sort of hedgehog fugacity, if you like. When this core energy is infinity, you're at this no hedgehogs model. You allow for a finite core energy, you allow hedgehogs. And then the question is, as you go to larger and larger system sizes, what does the system look like? Okay, just RG. And if you're in the nail phase, you're it's very expensive to make hedgehogs that are far apart. Okay, so you just flow back to the nail phase, if you like, of this hedgehog-free model. There's no real distinction as far as ground state properties go. Okay, what about this disordered phase? Okay, so if you introduce hedgehogs into this P star disordered phase, we know from old work by Polyakov that actually it's unstable. That putting in hedgehogs, if I start at this P star phase, put in a little bit of hedgehog fugacity, that hedgehog fugacity will grow and become large as I go to larger and larger system sizes. Okay, so that's this instability has been well known for many years, and what Reed and such, they've told us was that this will land you in the VBS phase. Proliferate hedgehogs with berry phases, you land in the VBS phase. Okay, so that's where this flow diagram goes, this flow goes. So the real question is about the transition, yeah. Yeah, if you start somewhere over here, right, then you'll just go off to the VBS. But we'll be in.
In general,
whether
they can just be
radical. Yeah, they can't. It'll come in a minute, yeah. Because the real question is about the transition. What happens at this quantum critical point that Lessig talked about? What happens if I introduce hedgehogs at this critical point? So now it turns out that the relevant question to ask over here is to ask about quadrupled hedgehogs. So I mentioned before that it's really these four hedgehogs that occur with uniform phase irrespective of where they are. So to test for stability, you should really test for stability of these four hedgehog operators. And what is established in this paper, and which I'll describe in a moment, is that in fact quadrupled hedgehogs are very likely irrelevant at this critical point. Okay, and the intuition for this is quite simple. When you have gapless matter fields, and you put in a hedgehog, that hedgehog actually corresponds to a monopole in the gauge theory language, and you have gapless fields that carry gate charge, so this really messes up their propagation, right? And it becomes expensive to put in monopoles when you have gapless matter fields, and that's why you might expect that in fact when you have gapless gate charge matter, monopoles have a harder time proliferating, and it could happen that they're actually irrelevant, and I'll give more detailed arguments why. In this particular case, for quadrupled hedgehogs, they're actually irrelevant at this critical point. Okay, but let's just for a moment accept this. And then we have a flow that looks like this, that flows into this critical point, where start of the finite hedgehog fugacity, I just flow back. This is stable to introduction of quadruple hedgehogs. Okay, so now to answer Zhaogang's question, if I start at the flow very close by, then I start with some finite hedgehog fugacity, but for a while the system thinks it's at the critical point and the hedgehog fugacity flows down, and only then does it realize that actually it's on the disordered side, it goes here, and then finally it realizes that actually hedgehogs are relevant and then goes up. So that's really the structure of the flow. We'll come back to that because it'll give us some interesting structure in interesting sequence of length scales over which these crossovers happen if you're close to the critical point. Okay, so this is really the three pieces of the argument, if you like. Hedgehogs are relevant at the disordered side, but irrelevant at the transition. Okay, so that's in the language of RG, that's a dangerously irrelevant operator. Irrelevant at the transition, but relevant in one phase and determines the properties of that phase. Okay, so once you specify these flows, you've already specified that there's actually a direct nail to VBS transition. Okay, so imagine walking across on some cut in parameter space, some particular value of hedgehog fugacity and J. So this is the cut in parameter space your system is walking through. You start here, you go to the nail phase. Over here, you go to the quantum critical point. And when you're here, you flow off eventually to the VBS phase. So your system has really gone from nail to VBS via this critical point. Yeah, and the critical theory is really given by this non-compact CP1 theory that Oleksii talked about. It's essentially that theory because these hedgehogs don't matter at the critical point.
Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah.
So, elaborate on this statement you made that at a critical point, the physical picture, it's hard for hedgehogs to,
Yeah, so that'll come here, yeah. Okay, so what's,
It sounded a little bit too trivial. I mean, it sounded like it's been driven by dangerous irrelevant variable.
Yeah.
That question, that diameter.
Yeah, but it's a very special, variable.
Yeah.
So it's...
Many problems of dangerous irrelevance.
Yeah, so it's not...
So
this has the physics of dangerous irrelevance, but that's not the only physics that it has.
Yes, what is the other one?
Yeah, so the dangerously irrelevant variable is a disorder parameter in this case, and it carries some additional quantum numbers. So, you know, when this variable is relevant in the phase, it gives you disorder, it kills nail phase, but it also gives you something more. It gives you the valence bond solid order. Yeah. Okay, so now let me tell you the argument why this four hedgehog tunneling is actually irrelevant at the quantum critical point, or why we believe that's true. So in order to do this, it's very useful to consider embedding our model in a larger family of models. And these were introduced by Sachdev and Jalabert many years back. So we were talking about the CP1 model throughout. So let's imagine, taking our two spinner fields and instead having spinner fields that range from 1 to n. Okay, so these are CPn-1 models, and we'll include Berry phase terms for the monopoles. Okay, so they're spinners coupled to gauge fields, have a compact gauge theory with certain Berry phases for the monopole events. So at n equals 2, it reduces to the case of interest, but otherwise it's a more general family of models. Okay, so in particular, there are n spinner fields at any given value of n. And this intuition that I talked about, having more and more gapless matter fields, giving rise to irrelevance of these hedgehogs, irrelevance of these monopole tunneling events, is something that you can see in this model by considering the, whether hedgehogs are relevant or not at criticality for various values of n. So you can do that for large n, and you can see that the scaling dimension of these hedgehog insertion operators is extremely, it's extremely irrelevant and goes as n. Okay, and that's another way of looking at it. So for very large n, you can solve this model, and you can see not just for any number of hedgehogs, even one hedgehog is going to be irrelevant for large n. Okay, what's more interesting is that you can consider this model for n equals 1, where you can use duality and establish various facts about this model, and it turns out that four hedgehogs are irrelevant at this critical point. Okay, but not less than four. So you've got to have at least four hedgehog tunneling. Four hedgehogs and larger are irrelevant at this critical point. Okay, so our case really, n equals 2 is something which has more gapless matter fields than the n equals 1 case, somewhere in between these two.
Okay.
And, yeah.
For n equals 1, how do I think of a hedgehog? I thought it was a...
Yeah, so this is, we're going to the CP1 models. So, you know, if you take the O3 model, you can write it as O3 model can be written as CP1. So two spinner fields coupled to a compact gauge theory. Now, once I'm in this representation, I can embed in a larger family of models. So you can't always go back,
okay,
right?
There's no
O n model that it corresponds to. It's some different family. But it's a very useful different family to look at. In fact, that's the relevant family to look at for these critical points. And that's just one charged field coupled to a non-compact gauge theory. So you can do a duality on that. And really, the case of interest is more gapless fields. And the fact that four hedgehogs are irrelevant at this point is very strong evidence that n equals 2 is it's also irrelevant. You can also consider a different deformation of this model, which is the easy plane limit, which Lessig talked about also for this hedgehog-free model. And here again, you can do duality, go to the dual theory that Lessig talked about. But the additional thing you can do is that you can actually write down what the hedgehog tunneling term looks like. Okay, so in the dual theory of two vortex fields, which correspond to vortices in either the Z1 or the Z2 spinner fields, so there are two vortex fields, and interconversion of these vortex fields corresponds to a hedgehog or a monopole, if you like. Okay, so testing for four hedgehog relevance irrelevance is equivalent to testing for the relevance irrelevance of this term, which is actually a very high order term, and you can consider this model in various limits and argue quite convincingly that this term is very likely relevant. So, okay, so let me very briefly mention some numerical work which may be relevant, may or may not be relevant to this physics. There's extremely large scale numerics done by Sandvik and collaborators some years back, and there's some more recent work by them where they consider easy plane spin half quantum magnet in the square lattice with some ring exchange term. Okay, so this ring exchange allows you to drive the system between from a nailed state present at k equals 0 to a valence bond solid state present for some larger values of k. Okay, and what they found was they found something that looked very much like a direct continuous transition where the spin stiffness was going down to 0 at the same point where the valence bond solid order parameter was rising up. And the question is this really direct continuous transition or not? And many issues are still not clear over here. But I think there'll be some sort of discussion just after this talk about some related model where, in fact, it's not believed to be continuous. But anyway, there are certainly lattice models where you can get the VBS phase and the nail phase in the same, within the same model by tuning some parameter. The question is, can one go through a parameter regime where one is intersecting this continuous transition? Okay, so now in the remaining 5 minutes or so, let me tell you about the properties of this transition, which are actually quite different from that of conventional transitions. The defining property of this transition is that there's this emergent conserved flux that arises because hedgehogs are irrelevant at the transition. Okay, so that's really the defining property. And that's something that's completely sharp. And there are several physical consequences of this. I'll just mention a couple of them. One of them is that if you just look at the correlations of this flux, so I told you that this flux is just the chirality of the nail vector. It corresponds to some very specific operator in theory. This flux-flux correlation, because it's the correlation of some conserved quantity, is completely specified by that statement, that you're critical, you have gapless matter fields and conserved flux. Okay, it has to go as 1 over r to the fourth. So that's an immediate consequence for a non-trivial operator. The second surprising conclusion that you get is that if you look at correlations of this of Plaquette order or of the columnar dimer order, these are some power laws at the transition, and it turns out that they have equal exponents. Okay, and this is irrespective of which ordered valence bond solid state it's going into. So if you're going to a Plaquette state, you'll find that the dimer order parameter at the transition is power law order, same exponent as Plaquette order. And that's a direct consequence of this, of interpreting the physics of this conserved flux arising. So it's really the hedgehogs, or the monopoles with berry phases that lock in your order. They're irrelevant at the, lock in your order into columnar dimer or Plaquette, and they're irrelevant at the transition. So it doesn't care which type you look at, the correlations of which type you look at. Okay, the second property of this transition, which is less rigorously defined than this first one, but is still very useful to keep in mind, is that there are these deconfined spin-ons that arise at this transition. Now, the reason this is a little subtle is because we're at a critical point where we don't really have well-defined particles. But one thing you can look at is the scaling dimension of this Snell field. And now from Oleksii's numerics, we know that the scaling dimension of this Snell field has some anomalous part, this eta, which is extremely large. Turns out to be 0.6 at this particular transition, this non-compact CP1 transition. And you should compare this against the eta for the regular Heisenberg transition. It's about 20 times smaller. Okay, so then it becomes a question of why is eta so large? But actually, in this way of thinking, where the N field is the square root of two of, you know, of this, the N field is the square of these spin-on fields, it's completely reasonable to have a large eta. And this is because if your the spin-on field Z were free, then you can easily work out that the scaling, the anomalous scaling dimension of the N field would just be unity. Okay, but of course, at the critical point, they're not quite free, so it's not quite unity, but it's something very large. Basically, because your magnon, this N field, is breaking up into two spin-ons, and it's a very poorly defined particle at the critical point. Okay, the other property of the transition that I want to point out is something that comes from a response to Xiaogang's question as well, that you know, as you approach the critical point, let's say we approach it from this valence bond solid side, there are actually two diverging length scales. Okay, the first diverging length scale is associated with the dangerous irrelevance of this hedgehog insertion operator. And there's another length scale, which is, of course, the quantum critical length scale, over which you see this power law correlations for the spins. Okay, and in between these two, sandwiched in between these two length scales, is really this P star phase that Lessig talked about, this free photon phase where spinons are effectively gapped, but your photons are gapless. Okay, so if you look at correlation functions as a function of distance close to this critical point, over some distance up to xi, you see quantum critical correlations. There's some intermediate region of length scales where you see things that are characteristic of free photon, and finally at some larger length scale, you establish VBS order. Okay, so if you like, if you want to be specific, you look at this, the Snell vector correlations over here, it's just quantum critical, it has this power law decay, but the flux-flux correlation goes as 1 over r to the fourth, like I described before, because you have this critical gauge theory. In this P-star phase, the spin-ons are gapped, essentially, so the spin-spin correlation is no longer power law, it doesn't look power law with this length scale, but this flux-flux correlation looks like that of a free photon, goes to 1 over r cubed with this very special dipolar form, and finally you get VBS order at the largest length scales. Okay, so that's the other property of these transitions. Okay, so let me wrap up with these, you know, some take-home messages, if you like. So really, these Landau forbidden transitions are possible for quantum phase transitions. And you know, to summarize it in one sentence, it's because you're because there's this disorder operator that carries some non-trivial quantum numbers, it condenses at this transition. That's one way of thinking about how you get Landau forbidden transitions. So you have a disorder operator, and when it condenses, it lifts the order. But it also carries some non-trivial quantum numbers, and that's allowed because this is a quantum system. And so when it condenses, you get a different type of order at the same time. Okay, so that's somehow the, that's really the lesson this is telling us. And the properties of this transition is best understood in terms of something which has a certain kind of topological order in the following sense, that there are no hedgehogs at the transition. And there's this, as a consequence, there's this emergent flux that's precisely conserved at the transition. And it's naturally described in terms of fluctuations of this flux, which are photons, and fractionalized variables, which are these spin-ons. Okay, that's, yeah.
Okay, so time for some questions and discussion.
In terms of your theory, what is the basic difference between easy plane and all three case? Which one is more transparent, or it doesn't matter at all?
It doesn't. There are some differences, but you know, the physics is basically the same. You know, you've got topological order at the transitions, emergent flux, and spinons that are critical. Mm. Now, one thing that's nice about the easy plane case is that it's self-dual. You can show that it's self-dual.
Because for me, the nice thing about easy plane case is that I can easily simulate it. That's why I'm asking.
So we can tell you more things about the easy plane case. For example, we know the scaling dimension of the hedgehog insertion operator at the easy plane case. We know this, the scaling dimension of the disorder operator. And the reason is that it's the same as the order field, the nail field. Okay, so we can give you an exponent for beta for the VBS order at this critical point for the easy plane case, which you can't do for the O3 case because it's not been calculated yet. It could be calculated, but it's not trivial to calculate.
So from all points of view, easy plane case is more transparent. At least it looks like more transparent.
They're both as good, I think. But easy plane, we can tell you a little bit more.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
In the physical model, what controls whether you're going to flow into that critical point? I mean, presumably, if the core energies of hedgehogs in the real spin model is small enough, then there'll be another multi-critical point, and you.
The core energy of the hedgehog is small enough.
Small enough.
Yeah, then it could flow off to, for example, a first order transition.
So what should I? What controls the?
Yeah, that's a good question. What microscopic parameters would you like to tune in order to be sure that you're going through this continuous transition? Yeah, it's not obvious to me. What coupling in the spin model would give me a extremely large core energy for the hedgehogs? It's a good question. I don't know.
Question from non-experts. Can you tell me that I haven't got the sense that from this talk, whether you think that it has been proven that at least for some special cases that there is a second order transition between two conventional phases of good order parameter, or it remains at the moment a very promising conjecture? That's one question. Second is, if it is proven, then in general, are there systematic ways to, or any qualitative ways to determine, suppose I'm given two order parameters with completely different conventional order, is there a way that I can tell a priori whether there is such a transition of this kind?
Yeah, so response to the first question, has it been proven? That sort of depends on your definition of proof, right? I mean, it's... So actually the one thing that might make it even more solid, if you like, is a direct computation of these four hedgehog, the scaling dimension of four hedgehogs at the transition. Right? If someone can do a direct numerical computation of that. So what we have is evidence that this, I gave you these three arguments. In every solvable deformation of this model, it's true that these four hedgehogs are relevant. And some of these deformations are such that the fluctuations are less than at the true critical point. So if anything, you expect that these things are more irrelevant than, for example, the n equals 1 model where the four hedgehogs are irrelevant. Right? You expect the scaling dimension to be even more irrelevant. Now, of course, that depends on your definition of proof, right? It would be extremely surprising if that was not the case, somehow at n equals 2 that happened. But of course, it's always, there's some small probability that that kind of thing happens because these are very strongly interacting critical points. So I think, at the level of sort of proving beyond any reasonable doubt for a physicist, the one thing that you could add to this that would really make it solid, that in principle this critical point exists, is to do a computation of the four hedgehog insertion operator, which is possible but not easy. Yeah. So your second question was...
Let me rephrase the second part, this question. Without Landau to help us, what are we to do?
Yeah, so you have two different orders. How do you know whether there's a continuous transition or not? I think this may actually just be the first example of a whole lot of different transitions that are possible between very different ordered phases. In fact, the number of possibilities increases a lot once you include fermions in your theory. So the reason we had only bosons in this theory, both spinons and photons as bosonic objects, allows you to analyze these theories very easily. But once you have fermions as well, the number of phases available to you is much larger. And I think Santhil will talk about some other kinds of phases. You can have direct transitions between extremely different phases, which can be described in terms of fermionic theories. So yeah, there's no answer to that now. It's interesting.
Hi. So I want to present an argument to argue that the transition between two phases with order parameter might not need fine-tuning in quantum phase transitions. I think if I start with your example, for instance, if I start with the valence bound state, which breaks the translational symmetry, I can imagine two kind of excitations. One involves the spin, which are the magnons or spin waves, which are fully gapped. There are also other kind of excitation involved the resonant moves of valence bound loop-like excitation, similar to what the Shalgam talked about yesterday. And if I vary your J, I have two scenarios. One is the spin branch touch the ground state first. Then I will have a transition from valence bound solid to near order state. And the second scenario will give your case. But to me, if I think this way, these two situations are equally possible, seems to me. There's no reason why one is preferred to the other one. The other situation is the loop-like excitation touch the ground state first.
What happens with the transition? You lose one of the parameters and get the other one immediately? Do you have an intermediate phase? Do you have coexistence?
At a critical point, it depends on which situation I have. I'm saying I can think about a situation where transitions from one order to stay to the other one, which doesn't require too much fine tuning.
Well, first of all, if just your magnon condenses, right, just your spin one excitation condenses, you're probably going into this coexistence phase. That looks like just a regular O3 transition. You just go into a coexistence phase. So it's, you don't get a direct transition just by condensing these magnons.
I have a comment and also relate to the Jason Ho's question. In the context of this Landau forbidden transition, in addition to this nice example, which you have a transition between two phases with a very different symmetry, there are also other example, which is a transition between two phases with exactly the same symmetry, like quantum Hall to multi-insular transition, and also transition between different supercounting states and some many Lagrangian states. And for this, whether we have some example which you have a continuous transition, this Landau forbidden continuous transition. I think in a double layer quantum Hall system, you could have a transition between two states with exactly the same symmetry, but the critical point happened to be the free fermion theory. So, and also the same thing happened in the quantum Hall transition, in a transition between supercounting states. So I think this free fermion critical point probably is kind of we know how to do. So that's maybe this it's probably not beyond the shadow of doubt, but a pretty much a proof. That is the transition critical point happened to be the free fermion. And all interaction include is there, but they are all irrelevant. So that's maybe the better. That's a kind of a reliable example that such transition do exist.
So what is the transition between in the quantum in the bilayer quantum Hall? It's things that differ in topological order, or
The transition in quantum Hall is will be the transition from the say 3-3-1 state to the single layer 1/2 state of a paired electron. Mm-hmm. And also the in the supercounting states there's a
it's weak to strong
D wave
It's a weak to strong pairing transition in a D wave superconductor where there's nodal quasiparticles at weak attractive interaction. If you crank up the interaction strong enough, those nodes coalesce and disappear. And that's the critical point he's referring to.
So Asher is the first question. I don't know which parameter you have to
do it. So Ashwin, So the Neil state itself doesn't have any specific love for square as opposed to orthorhombic or whatever transitions. Can you comment on how importantly this is all tied to exact square symmetry? And
yeah, so for example, they're saying, let's say we break the X and Y rotation, 90 degree rotation symmetry. Yeah, so in that case, of course, the disordered phase, the valence bond solid phase, is just doubly degenerate. For example, the so I showed you here four different valence bond solid states. There are four different valence bond solid states for the square lattice symmetry. But when you have, let's say, this bond stronger than the vertical bond, then you expect only two degenerate states. And that's actually something that you can see from your from this O3 sigma model with Berry phases.
I guess the question was, how much of your conclusions about the critical point will survive square symmetry and
I'm coming to that. Yeah, so it turns out in that case that it's not four hedgehogs that are the operator that you have to test, but in fact two hedgehogs. You know, it's a two hedgehog creation insertion operator that you need to test when you break this 90 degree rotation symmetry. And of course, that's something that's you know, more likely to be relevant than the four hedgehog insertion operator. Now, if that turns out to be irrelevant, the two hedgehog insertion operator turns out to be irrelevant, then you can have a direct continuous transition even in the case when you break this 90 degree symmetry. But otherwise, you would again get this deconfined criticality. Now, if you break square lattice symmetry in such a way that you can find a dimer pattern that doesn't break any of the lattice symmetries at all, then you just expect the regular O3 transition, and none of this emergent flux sort of exotic critical point occurring. So it's very much tied into the fact that you have square lattice symmetry. It's extremely crucial in this physics, and it has to do with the cancellation of Berry phases coming from hedgehog insertions. Yeah, so that's completely crucial. Yeah, so if you had phonons, for example, you might think that as you approach this critical point, this continuous critical point may be driven weakly first order because of phonons, which just give you spin pearls as you approach. But in this sort of idealized model where you have none of that, it's perfectly, you can argue that it's going to be truly continuous. And then with phonons, you hope that it's weakly first order, and finite temperatures, you see some of this criticality again. Yeah. Can you say it again? Sorry. Yeah. So if you have you break the symmetry in such a way that there's a unique dimer pattern selected out, then it's a regular O3.
I actually want to go back to what Shagang was saying. So he was mentioning that you could have quantum phase transitions between two states with the same symmetry, and I can give us somewhat different example. So if you take, sorry Matthew, I'm not doing this deliberately, the Fisher lattice in two dimensions, you can write a quantum dimer model and you go between two phases, both of which have the same symmetries. The phase transition is the three-dimensionalizing transition, which is not free fermions. Now, this is not surprising because the whole thing is constructed to exactly mimic, in other words, the Fisher lattice is how you get to a dimer model from the Ising model. And this is again, so this is also the dual is easy to gauge theory. And of course, Wegener constructed gauge theories in order to have phase transitions without order parameters. So that particular stream, so what's nice here is, of course, that you're using something, you know, which is outside that toolbox.
Yeah,
but exactly. One can certainly write Landau forbidden transitions, and indeed Wegener wrote them. For which there's no question.
So there's one important distinction there. Yeah. So we're used to phases that don't have order parameters, and you can have transitions between such phases.
Yeah.
And okay, in some sense, that's also outside Landau's original formulation.
Right.
But here, what's surprising is that both these phases are completely characterized by order parameters.
Right.
And in that sense, you might think that it should be within Landau's paradigm. We're not going out of Landau's paradigm in that direction, right? Finding phases that don't have order parameters.
Sure, but if you say that you can have a continuous transition absent an order parameter whatsoever, then
conversely, perhaps it's not so surprising, although beautiful.
I think maybe Santhal has a comment about it too.
You said exactly what I was going to say.
Okay.
Well, Shankar would say the one advantage we have over land is that we're still alive. Right? let me see. I guess what's your Boris? I won't try to pronounce your last name, but Svistanov had a brief remark he wanted to make, and so let's. Yeah, and no, I'll show some numerical results. I think. Anyway, let's thank Ashwin once again for a beautiful talk.
So, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me this chance of presenting our Palm Fresh Monte Carlo results. Basically, we were simulating a model which is qualitatively equivalent to the model simulated in these references, in this work, and it's a kind of generalized J-current model, a discrete analog of a quantum system in D plus one. First of all, I would like to make a general comment on what will be seen in a finite size cluster simulation if we, for example, have a deconfined critical point in our system. A very important circumstantial evidence would be the region where both superfluid and solid order parameters are suppressed, because the consequence of the existence of these two scales, which are characteristic to the deconfined critical point, is that at some value of control parameter, our system size is much larger than smaller correlation radius, and where the superfluid order should be suppressed, but still much smaller than the correlation radius at which solid order parameters should appear. However, in the above-cited simulation and in our simulation as well, we see the picture like that, which actually has very little to do with this situation. So it's actually,
I don't think this theory predicts the picture on the left.
Okay. It's just my comment, because I'm not insisting on it. Okay. So this is the plot which we see for system size, a linear system size 16, and in the insets you see the difference with this cluster and larger ones. So actually everything looks like a first order phase transition, but with some very peculiar feature. We do not see any hysteresis. So the next step is to figure out what is actually going on. So why this why this looks like a first order phase transition but without a hysteresis. So we do the following. We take the critical point and cluster of the system size 16, and we just take some representative ensemble of states, and each point is one representative of our ensemble, and along the axis are some linear combinations of valence bond order. So this is sum of valence bond order along x and y, and this is the difference. So we see this black square, and it tells us that at the critical point we see simultaneously both orders, both solid orders, and moreover, we see simultaneously the superfluid order. So the system behaves like a quasi or four model when we have a coexistence of all possible orders just in one bottle. So I cannot just show on this two-dimensional plot the superfluid order, but I can tell you the following. If the point is on this perimeter, the superfluid order is totally suppressed. And it's maximum if the point is in the center. So basically everything is like a four-dimensional rigid vector. So, and we have direct parallels apart from this parallel with Malevich. We see this parallel with all three Heisenberg critical point, which is basically the critical point when an anti-ferromagnet goes from easy plane to easy axis. And of course, the qualitative equivalence with the SO5 theory of the superconductor to anti-ferromagnet transition. And this is basically the smoking gun evidence of the first order phase transition, which we have here. So this is some effective quantity, which is very convenient to describe what's going on in our system. So if the system size is small enough, we see this quasi O4 behavior. But when we increase the system size, we see that we start to develop this typical bimodal distribution, which is a smoking gun evidence of the first order phase transition. And this is the comparison with the superfluid checkerboard critical point. We see no qualitative difference. So basically, the two transitions from superfluid to valence bond solid and superfluid to checkerboard solid looks pretty similar. And actually, it's not surprising if we discuss them in terms of word lines, but it just goes beyond my comment. Okay, thank you.
Do you have varied phases within your
model? No, we are working with word lines as you do. So it's a good comment because I would like to see the translation from the language of hedgehogs and berry phases into the language of word lines.
What filling are you at? I mean, these are what boson world lines. Are you at integer filling?
Half filling. Yeah. We're adding the same system. Otherwise, we would have marked transition instead of checkerboard or valence bond solid. So the model is qualitatively the same, and the plots are qualitatively the same. You see that just if I show you my plot and you compare it to the previous, you will see no difference.
But we don't see the kind of stiffness behavior that you showed there varying on the crossing at the critical point.
The crossing?
Yeah, we don't see that. We see algebraic finite size scaling at the critical point.
Yeah, you mentioned it. So maybe you need just to try to see exactly the same quantities by modal distribution.
Yeah, but already, you know, in some quantities we do look at, we see different things. I don't think your model is the same as our model.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm kind of totally confused because the previous two talk about the purely spin system. There's no charge, and here you seem to have a superfluid. So
there is no charge either. We do not have a Coulomb interaction. Everything is absolutely local.
So, but what is superfluid?
Excuse me.
The x-y order. Oh, I see. So you have this spinless boson representing spin.
Yeah, x-y.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, good. I think we should move on then. Thanks. Thanks again. This is the